Good morning and welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, we welcome three economists who happen to be women. Denise Conan is Dean of the College of Social Sciences and Professor of Economics at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She served as Interim Chancellor of UH Manoa and Department Chair. Conan's background is in international trade. She's worked extensively in Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, and has been a consultant to the World Bank, the Council of Foreign Relations, the Arab League, and the governments of Egypt, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Hawaii. Her interests include regional economic integration, trade and services, intellectual property rights, and foreign direct investment and energy. Teresa Molina is assistant professor in the Department of Economics at UH Manoa. She has a BA in economics from Stanford University and a PhD in economics from the University of Southern California. Her research primarily focuses on health and education in developing countries. And originally from Kaneohe, A.B. Trenhale is a foreign service officer at the State Department. She works in Washington, D.C. and just happens to be home for the holidays. She's done tours at U.S. embassies in China and Pakistan. She graduated from UH Manoa's College of Social Sciences with bachelor degrees in economics and political science and holds a master's degree in international economics from Johns Hopkins University. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad you could join us. But before we jump into this and throw light on this field and the need for diversity at the top, can we just go around the table and just maybe reflect on the state of the economy, at this point in time?
Sure. Denise Conan, well, I guess one thing that stands out to me is how dynamic things are in the area of international trade. For decades, we had had such stability under the World Trade Organization and sort of a kind of a global engagement, an idea of global rules of the game. And in the past couple years, we've just really moved in a bilateral way with negotiations that are happening that just is throwing a lot of uncertainty about trade relations, and it's highly linked with political relations.
Yeah, we were just actually talking to a Hawaii businessman who's in Hong Kong, and he was just talking about how the tariffs were affecting, like, California wines, and now it's his business.
Yes.
He distributes
yes.
it.
Yes, big impacts on agriculture and also supply chains, big changes. And I think as much as the tariffs, it's the uncertainty of not knowing what the structure is going to be. So that impacts investment. Even with some of our closest trade partners like Canada and Mexico.
Right. So yeah. Lots of uncertainty hanging overhead.
Hanging overhead.
Many
yes.
countries. and Teresa, what's your take from where you sit with your background?
So I'm a development economist, which means I'm interested in, poverty alleviation kind of across the globe. And as you mentioned, the three Nobel laureates in economics this year were actually our development economists. And so it's kind of an exciting time for the field. And as a development economist, and I think as a citizen in general, it's kind of easy to be discouraged by the things that are happening in the world more broadly. But I do want to reflect on some of the really good things that have happened over the past few decades. So, for example, child mortality has fallen dramatically across the globe, so that the average global rate today is as low as the rate that the richest countries were seeing kind of in 1960. 15 countries lifted millions of people out of extreme poverty between 2000 and 2015. So there are a lot of good things going on across the globe that it is kind of easy to forget about. So I just wanted to bring some of those to light.
Right. With the local headlines, we see, where homelessness, maybe up mm-hmm. Across the country, that it's nice to have that global perspective mm-hmm. that we are making progress in some areas.
Yeah.
And Abby, what about you? Yeah, you have a background and you're currently working in D.C. where mm-hmm. there's a lot of political changes. But so what's your take on where you sit?
Basically, I think I'll just give my personal perspective on what I see going on. It's really fascinating to watch from Washington, to see all the negotiations that are going on, and to hear the news. But I will say what I think is encouraging is that there's a lot of people who care, not only in Hawaii, but in D.C., about pushing for positive policies, and who just ask the right questions and who are thinking deeply about what our policies mean for the long term as well. And so for me, it's been really a great honor to be able to work with them and hear from them and to be able to be part of the conversation with them.
And then you have degrees in poli-sci and economics.
Yes.
Did you ever think that you were going to go into the Foreign Service?
Not at all. No, not at all. I actually came to the Foreign Service actually via Hawaii because the APEC Summit came to Hawaii in 2011. And I was with Dr. Conan at that time. And during that time, we were able to work with the State Department and a lot of their diplomats who were in town helping to plan the summit and put on those different events. And I was exposed to them during that time. And that's part of the reason why I decided to join the Foreign Service.
Yeah, that was a real eye-opener, I think, for everybody in the state, you know, from in law enforcement, locally, federally. Gosh, it was like, are we ready to host these world leaders?
Well, that was an exciting time. And at the time, I was nominated by President Greenwood to be the point person for the University of Hawaii. I'm a trade economist, so it was a natural position for me to play. And it was an exciting opportunity for students because really my top priority was exposing our students to that opportunity. And Abby was one of those that was able to participate in a very meaningful way on behalf of our state, working directly with the State Department so that the state would be ready to host such a big meeting. So, you know, our students got great exposure.
Yeah, front row seats, really.
Front row seats. And we're really behind the scenes helping with some very important activities at that time. And it's been a real honor to see the direction that that kind of exposure can give to our graduates. So we hope more things like that will come our way.
Yeah, it was funny, just this very moment, reflecting back on APEC, one thing that struck me was just the security. I was very appreciative of what a wonderful place that we live in now, where, you know, we had never really thought about having to glue down the manhole covers in the streets because of, you know, terrorism. I mean, it was just a different way of looking at things because security was, you know, really, you know, top of the list because of hosting these world leaders. It's a fascinating experience.
Yeah, that's true.
So it was interesting to hear your takeaway that got you interested.
Yeah, and actually at the time we met a former ambassador, Lauren Moriarty, who is from Hawaii. And at the time, she came and she spoke to us. And I remember being very inspired by her and hearing her talk about her travels and what she had done to represent U.S. interests abroad. And then what she was doing now to give back to Hawaii and to help serve as one of the senior advisors for this summit. And so really that, I think she, when I look back on my career, she was definitely one of the people who inspired me to join.
She's someone important to call out. Lauren Moriarty was an economics major at the University of Hawaii, graduated with us, and she was the first Native Hawaiian ambassador in the United States. She was ambassador to APEC, so was heavily involved in the APEC summit.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Teresa, you had shared earlier that you actually grew up in Japan.
Yes.
So you have this, you know, international kind of perspective too. What was it like, I guess, knowing that the APEC was here, you know, and you know these world leaders descending on this tiny island?
I actually wasn't living here at the time. I was I wasn't living here at the time, but I definitely heard about. I would always kind of hear about the APEC because, like I said, it's, you know, being from Japan, you kind of always know when those types of things are going on. So it was really interesting to hear Abby and Denise's perspective. I can't even imagine kind of being in the thick of things. Those always seem very, very distant to me.
Oh, yeah. It was very exciting.
Very exciting.
On so many levels. And you had mentioned Esther Duflo winning the Nobel Peace Prize. We do have a clip from her acceptance speech when they announced that in October.
Today, I'm also proud to represent women, and in particular, women in science and economics. Tellingly, Elinor Ostrom, the only other woman before me who won the economics prize, also relied on fieldwork and studied what we can learn from poorer societies, from Nepal to Indonesia. I don't think this is an accident. Development is one field of economics that has its fair share of women. Some of my own work has been on the importance of women as role models. I cannot help but hope that this prize, with its emphasis on the essential questions of how to improve the life of others, and with one woman among the laureates, will encourage many others to come join us. So on behalf of Abhijit Banerjee, Michael Kremer, and me, we want to thank the Royal Swedish Academy of Science, the Sveriges Bank, and the Nobel Foundation for honoring us and the movement that is transforming development economics and the fight against poverty with this Nobel Prize. There is a lot of work left to do against poverty and to fight climate change, and we better get back to it. Thank you very much.
So talk about what it was like when you saw her win this award for poverty.
Yeah, it was actually really exciting because she was one of my idols, I guess you would say, economist, female economist idols, I would say, back in undergrad when I first kind of started dipping my toes into the field. I read a lot of her work in the development classes that I was taking, and I remember always being struck by how creative and inspiring her research ideas were and how she was able to use economic tools to apply them to questions that I thought were really interesting. And I've kind of followed her work as she's developed her agenda. And it was really nice surprise to hear that she and her colleagues had won the prize for her work.
And she talked about how she, you know, wants to be an inspiration for more women to get into this field. You know, what were your thoughts when you saw the award go to her?
Oh, it was a proud moment for sure. And it did remind me of the, there are a handful, just a small number of stellar female economists that were important in my history. You know, I think I mentioned to you earlier that that when I was an undergraduate student, I was the only female major in economics in my small college. But I had this opportunity to have Alice Rivlin come to campus, and I was able, she's the first chair of the U.S. Congressional Budget Office. So she was the most prominent woman in economics in the political realm at that time, and for many years. And she came to campus, and I was able to introduce her. I had done a lot of research on her, and she was very encouraging. And so that kind of, you know, impact can make a big impact, having that kind of personal conversation. There's a few other women like that, but very few. So Joan Robinson is somebody who I admired. She was, in the kind of post-Keynesian realm. She came up with a concept we call monopsony. So you hear of a monopoly, but the idea that there can be monopsony power in terms of sellers and buyers. And another that was very important to me was Ann Krugman. Mm-hmm. She was a prominent trade economist who developed models around the negative impacts of quotas would have on trade policy. And it was a pleasure to host her here at UH Manoa. She's come to visit, and she had a condo on the Big Island, so she would come quite often, and so really fortunate. But really, there's the number of prominent female economists. We do need to increase that. We do. So
anybody else want to talk about other mentors that they looked up to?
Sure. I'll also mention, I'm actually sitting at this table with one of my mentors and role models, Dr. Conan. She was really the reason why I decided to study economics at University of Hawaii. When I came in, I was studying political science, and when I took one of her classes, that really turned me on and got me interested in thinking about what economics means and how economic policies shape politics and vice versa, because Dr. Conan always brought a good perspective about political economy. I also think another woman who I think was very a good role model for me was I interned before at the USTR, the United States Trade Representative, and there I worked for a representative who was a woman. And I remember she was so astute in how she did negotiations and how she handled herself in male-dominated fields. So I just remember watching her and seeing how she interacted and trying my best to try to absorb all of that when I was in the room with her.
And what about you, Tracer?
Yeah, I think thinking about this now, it's it really hits me that role models are really important. I don't think necessarily I realized it at the time. So as an undergrad, as I mentioned, I was interested in development. I took several development classes, one with Professor Seema Jayachandran, another one with Anjani Kochar, and just I don't think it was an accident that I gravitated towards these women as role models and found myself really interested in the work that they were doing and kind of starting to get that feeling of aspiring to be what, you know, more like them, right? And so I think so these two were really big role models for me, and I don't think I realized at the time that I wanted to go and get a PhD and then eventually become a professor in economics, but looking back now they definitely played a big role.
And I, as I was just reading up on female economists, there were some notable women. Edith Abbott, I guess, had a hand in drafting the Social Security Act of 1935. Janet Yellen was the first woman to be the chair of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. So these women got up to the top, you know, and then we had Eleanor Ostrom. She was the first one to win the Nobel Prize for economics, you know, and that was 10 years ago. Right. And so when I was watching this on TV, I was just struck, like, why don't we have more women?
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, maybe it's a different time now. I remember when I was going through graduate school, there being so few women, well, of course, in my undergrad, also grad experience, that there is a feeling that, you know, I felt like, okay, the average guy can get through, you know, the economics PhD, but an average woman maybe couldn't. And so one had to really work hard, prove themselves above and beyond in order to sort of carve your way. And I think that made me a better economist, a better, you know, more focused person. But I did feel that pressure. Mm-hmm. I want to give a shout out to Ann Carlos at University of Colorado and Jamie Cruz. These were two female economists that that actually pulled the women together and had a mentoring session for us and you know, really helped us navigate the economics profession. Because there's, you know, there's a lot of culture that goes along with being an economist. And so how you play in that when is something you have to navigate. But yeah, so I think those women who then survive, they tend to be spectacular, as you can see from around this table.
Yes.
So proud of the women here.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. And if you're just joining the conversation, we're talking about the role of women in economics, and we'd like to know what you think. Join the discussion. Call us at 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. And, you know, just this morning I saw there were headlines from the BBC talking about, and the headline is, you know, why didn't the Bank of England appoint a woman? And, you know, so obviously this is not just a problem here in the U.S. You've got this problem of the glass ceiling, I guess, in other mm-hmm. countries where it's just a predominantly male-dominated industry. I don't know if you want to share, if you've had experiences that just made it tough as you were going through school and working your way up. Who wants to start? Abby?
Sure. I could talk a little bit about perceptions, particularly working overseas as a woman. You know, I've worked in some really interesting places, but places that may not have the same ideals and values as the United States, which isn't necessarily wrong, but it does make it challenging as a female in the workplace. I can think of, for example, when I worked in Beijing, when I would show up to meetings, you know, because I'm from Hawaii and I'm Hapa, I'm not Chinese though, but I would show up to these meetings and they would be like, oh, you must be the half Chinese interpreter for a meeting with the men, right? And so that was a common perception that I had and that I had to manage and handle throughout my career, I think.
And that was in China. Mm-hmm.
That was in China. But those kind of perceptions are true in basically all these types of very hierarchical, male-dominated cultures. You'll face that everywhere, I think.
Yeah, and I think in that article with the BBC, they were talking about there's just this lack. It's a startling lack of female economists across the globe, you know. So It's a real eye-opener.
Yeah, this brings up, I mean, Abby brings up, so I've been a trade economist working in places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Tunisia. And of course, you know, it is also this kind of hierarchical environment. Sometimes it can be a good thing because what I see is that I really stand out. They will not forget who I am. Mm-hmm. You know, I can go to a meeting and it commands attention because it is unusual. So that can be a beneficial thing. It can be an awkward thing at times. But so often I found that, you know, there is a welcoming, you know, kind of wish that more women were involved. But just how to make that happen is a puzzle.
Yeah. You want to share an experience that you've
yeah,
had?
So I think, first of all, I'd like to say that I think I've been very lucky as a woman in economics, and things have definitely changed since Dean Conan was in school. I had plenty of other women in my undergraduate and PhD programs, but it's definitely, you know, so I've definitely, I think, gotten used to being one of very few female professors kind of in the room or at conferences. I sometimes maybe should take this as a compliment, but I definitely get mistaken as a graduate student when I'm at conferences and things like that, when I don't think my male colleagues experience these same types of things. And so there are moments where I'm definitely reminded that we are very much underrepresented in this field, and it really makes you think kind of how can we do better.
Janice, are there any, I don't know, other stories you can share? Just maybe how you were treated differently as a female economist? I don't know.
Some of that I can share, some that I probably shouldn't. Let's see, what would be? Well, I think there was, especially... Yeah, you know, I sort of remember back in a certain time, the expectation on the women was quite. I think there was an expectation, a question about what our focus would be. Would we be dedicated to the profession, or would we be kind of opting out
taking
of the labor
leave,
force,
right.
Taking maternity leave, and in fact that was actually at the time that I started off as an assistant professor, very hard to do. You know, my first son, Joseph, was, you know, Joseph.
Yeah.
He was born mid semester, and there wasn't a maternity leave option at that time. You know, I was back in the classroom. He was born kind of 5 weeks early, but I was back in the classroom within 2 weeks after his birth.
Well, I recall just when I was in TV news, I remember I was expecting, and I told my boss, and he goes, you know, you're the first one to be pregnant in 12 years.
Yeah.
And then I realized, whoa, you know.
Yeah.
And so,
I mean, so I think, you know, my colleagues were very supportive, but they didn't really understand. I don't know. I think other departments had ways to adjust. So there was, you know, just an expectation.
If it's historically underrepresented for women, right, there is no policy in place. I think that's the issue. People don't think about it because they haven't had to for, like you said, like 10 years.
Right. So
that's
it's like
right.
Kind of breaking new ground. But there's also then a lot of pressure and burden, like, okay, and how's this going to work? And you try harder,
yep.
I think.
Yeah,
right?
So you just, you know, so you find a way, you just make it work, and it just is.
Can we talk about numbers?
Yes.
Because
yes.
I don't know what it's like, you know, nationally and here at, say, UH Manoa.
I pulled up some numbers for us. And, you know, nationally, we've been talking about this issue in the economics profession recently. There's a committee on the status of women in the economics profession. They're very active at trying to promote women engagement at conferences. But we talk about a leaky pipeline. And it expresses itself like this, you know, right now, you know, when students are taking principles of economics, it's it's just a little bit under 50-50 representation of males and females. But those choosing to major in economics nationally is about 39%. Those females going into a PhD program drops then to 25%. Those becoming faculty after a PhD program or surviving the PhD going into faculty drops down to like 16%. Those reaching the status of a full professor, that's at about 9%.
Wow.
And so you see it sort of at each stage just, you know, a little tighter in terms of the representation of males and females. I think, you know, it's an issue here in Hawaii too. And in our economics department, we've been working really quite hard at trying to promote women in the economics profession. We had a grant recently to, and Sumner LaCroix was leading this effort to try to increase engagement for women, but still we have numbers that reflect pretty closely national standards. So our faculty, we're higher than the 16% nationally. We're at 23% females. Of our faculty, 21 faculty members, we have five women. Three of those are full professors, and that's pretty remarkable and good. Also, at the PhD level, we are better than the national average, too. We have 37% female PhD graduate students. But at the undergraduate level, only one in four undergraduate majors is an econ major. So there's a lot that needs to happen to make the economics profession attractive to our undergraduate students.
But at least the climate at UH Manoa appears to be welcoming, warming.
Yes. We're putting a lot of effort into that. I think we're trying to do things like have talks where we bring out local women who have been successful in the economics profession to help our students see and aspire to what is possible, what might be achievable. Trying to get some of our female faculty in front of undergraduate students earlier, things like that.
Right, develop role models.
Exactly.
For folks, yeah. Well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Our roundtable today includes female economists. You can join the discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break.
You forget the car keys on the kitchen counter. The babysitter calls to cancel as you're running out the house. Some curveballs affect you for a few hours, others for a lifetime.
I just did something extremely wrong, and this isn't right. And I knew I had hurt myself.
Stories of reinventing yourself on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 7, following Says You.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. If you're just joining us, our guests in our studio are Denise Konan, the Dean of the College of Social Sciences and Professor of Economics at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Teresa Molina is Assistant Professor in the Department of Economics at Manoa. And Abby Trenhale is a Foreign Service Officer at the Department of State. She graduated from UH Manoa's College of Social Sciences with bachelor's degrees in economics, political science, and she has a master's in international economics. We have our phone lines open, and we have a call coming in from Nancy from Manoa.
Aloha. Catherine, thank you so much for having these inspiring, brilliant activist, scholar, feminist on your program. I just wanted to join the chorus in thanking Dean Denise Konan, because she is a great mentor indeed, and she shines her light to bring everybody involved, especially young women. So thank you, Denise, for that.
Oh, Nancy, thank you.
My question is, I think sort of the subtext in what you're all saying, and I would love to have it elaborated a little bit, specifically regarding development economists and bringing more women into the field. There's a definite political and qualitative result when you have women in fields. And I think the kinds of grassroots issues they're involved in really address the structural inequalities of poverty and underdevelopment, and some ways that, you know, mainstream economics doesn't do. So I wonder if you could speak to those specific issues which have a deep political context to them.
Teresa, you want to take this?
Sure, yeah. Your question reminds me a lot about some economics literature on how having female representation politically does matter in terms of what these females will do while in office. And so we've been mentioning Esther Duflo a lot in this conversation, but she has found that when women are, so she uses kind of a very cool research design to determine this, but she finds that when women are in office, they're more likely to spend things to invest in types of projects that benefit women more. And so it makes you realize that when women are underrepresented in office, it's actually a huge, it's kind of a huge trickle-down effect in terms of women not getting what they need and what they prioritize. And so having women kind of in these leadership roles isn't just about, you know, isn't just about having them as role models, but it also makes tangible differences in terms of what money is spent on and so forth.
Denise, you want to add something here?
Well, I was just looking up some statistics about the difference of that having women economists in the policy realm being able to comment on policy does make such a difference. I had pulled up some statistics here recently that, you know, in a survey where economists were asked about the pay gap between men and women, if there's a gender gap, a common view is that is because of choice of profession, that, you know, women choose to go into professions that result in lower pay. But if you break that number down a little bit, that view is held by 56% of the male economists, but only 19% of the female economists. So, you know, really there is much that needs to happen to get a female perspective and understanding, you know, into our policy realm, into the development realm.
So the men think, oh, the reason why there's the pay inequity is because the women are choosing areas where you aren't going to get paid as much.
That's right. That's right. Where women have a much more nuanced view of it, much a different understanding.
And you talked about the numbers just in the classroom, but in looking at this issue, I mean, it seems it's like it's everything. It's tenure in a department. It's,
right.
There's not enough people, not enough women in the Federal Reserve. You know,
that's
a
right.
Headline recently, KQED story was that there's a push to break up the boys' club at the Fed, and until you let women know, you know, these things are
it's
possible.
Difficult.
Yeah,
it's difficult
to get folks to say I can see myself in that position, you know, and go for it.
That's right, because you need those role models out there. But also women are put in, often when you're in a minority, and this happens for many minorities, you're put in a position where then also you're the one on the service committees, you're the one being tapped to be the representative, the token woman on those committees. And it makes it difficult to make professional progress in your work and your research when you're tap like that, if that makes sense.
Are there organizations that link women economists across the globe? You know, I mean, if England's having trouble at the Bank of England, you know, they've never had a woman there. I mean, are there avenues to network like that?
We do at our American Economic Association, we have a committee on the status of women in the economics profession, and they are quite active in mentoring women. They are, I found it very helpful, their newsletter that they put out providing, you know, tips to women in terms of the economics profession. And at every professional meeting, they have networking breakfasts and things like this to try to provide that kind of support where women may otherwise not be able to link with one another. So, yeah, I think the women have been very active in the economics profession. Teresa,
just,
what do you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, just to add to that, actually, CSWEP, this organization that you're talking about, they also run a formal mentoring program that I was fortunate enough to be a part of a few years ago. And what it is essentially is it brings junior professors, so junior female economists, together with successful senior professors at one of the annual conferences, and they break you up into small groups, and so that you have a nice kind of small group, almost one-on-one interaction with these inspiring female economists, and they mentor you for that time, for that, you know, the short time period that we're there. They give us advice. They give us advice on research, on work-life balance, on navigating the political, the politics of being an academic. But also, in addition, they kind of are there to check up on you going forward. And I've been really fortunate enough to have been a beneficiary of that.
And we should maybe talk about some of the women in our community, the leaders in our community, who may have gone into other fields, but maybe started in economics. And Denise, I think you had mentioned Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa.
Yeah, some of our prestigious alum from University of Hawaii are Colleen Hanabusa, who did an economics major before she went on to law school. And she talks about how that has influenced her and gave her kind of a very rational way of decision making in a political environment. Another I want to call out is Pearl Imada Eboshi, who for many years was the Hawaii state economist, and she's a good friend of mine too, and she's currently director of research at University of Hawaii. Of course, there's also Connie Lau, Catherine Ngo, and I would also say Mary Sellers, all involved in the banking sector.
Right, and there's Donna Tenoy, who's with FDIC.
Donna Tenoy, yes.
You know, so there are a lot of folks then, I guess, either start out in economics and go in other fields. And, you know, Abby, you know, you're in the State Department, right? You said that you didn't realize that you would go into the Foreign Service.
No, not at all. I think the important thing is that an economics degree really gives you that kind of analytical framework you need for thinking about, you know, hard, challenging questions and how to solve a problem, right? Because essentially that's what our jobs are, right? You get a problem, how are you going to deal with it? And I think economics gives you that kind of framework. And I will say that in my career, even though I obviously don't strictly do economics every day, from briefing policymakers to doing reporting to doing outreach and public diplomacy events, economics and the policies, especially for that particular country that you're working on, will always come up in the conversation, because those are the things that guide political relationships within that country, right, and vice versa. And those are the things that also shape our own bilateral relationship with the United States. So having that kind of foundation and understanding, I think, is essential for any type of job that you do, really.
And I just remember, you know, in grade school, taking, you know, civics and social studies and realizing, yeah, there's the political part, but then the trade stuff, it's like, wow, that's where a lot of the power is and the negotiating tools. So it's just interesting living in this time when you see kind of the global unrest and you see how the trade is so complicated,
yes.
Whether it's Hong Kong, you know, or Venezuela or somewhere else. You know, and I don't know, maybe in other countries, you know, like the Philippines, you know, where there's just a different dynamic going on. I don't know. Anybody else want to chime in here on those issues?
Well, it was that understanding that first inspired me to become an economics major. And one thing I do want to portray to your listeners is how exciting it is to be an economics major. I encourage more women to get into the field, and you know, we can. So when I was an undergraduate student, I had this opportunity to go to Haiti, and I was so taken. I had taken many courses. I really wanted to make a difference in people's lives. I had a very optimistic view. But in Haiti, looking at the poverty, the severe poverty that was there, I just had this kind of inspiration that if they could be more a part of the world trading system, that their standard of living could be higher. And that's when I decided to become a trade economist. And I've just been so honored and fortunate to be able to work in that area, to be able to, I had no idea as an undergraduate student that I would have this opportunity to be an advisor to nations, to advisor to ministries on their trade policy, on how countries like Egypt could, how they could or should liberalize their trade policies to become more integrated in a world economic system, how that could raise standard of living for poor people in their economies. And I've been fortunate to do that in various settings with Egypt, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, the Arab League, to be able to see how policies can influence standards of living. I think now, as I you know, that was an optimistic youth, but when I look at it now, I can see how political trade policy is. It's not all about what are the economic benefits to, for example, the U.S. or our trading partners. We're not always looking for multilateral gains from trade, but trade is a powerful tool to accomplish other political means, and you can see that playing out, I think, right now.
You know, when I was listening to Esther's speech, and she ended with, you know, we have to get back to these issues of poverty and climate change. And I was struck because I remember I was fortunate enough to go to China and see how incredibly advanced they were in some areas, and yet was so sad about the pollution.
Yeah.
Where I just felt sad for the whole world because it was so polluted in Beijing. And they were warnings everywhere. And I think at the time they were prepping for the Olympics, and they were trying to plant rose bushes to try and help offset some of the pollution, but it was so bad. So I'm struck by that. And I don't know, Teresa, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I definitely think pollution is one a huge issue that comes up a lot in development. And I think a lot of people might think, you know, when they think of economists, they might think that economists only care about growth and industrialization, and maybe we actually don't care too much about pollution, but that's not true at all. There's a huge increase in the number of studies that have been conducted about the negative effects of pollution. I've actually have some work in Mexico documenting that early life exposure to pollution can have negative consequences kind of years into adolescence and adulthood. And so this is something that economists care about quite a bit, and there's been a lot of talk about the best ways to make sure that, you know, with industrialization, we just don't come with this kind of rampant increase in pollution. You know, carbon taxes have been a big part of the discussion. Getting communities, so local communities, kind of invest in their own ways to protect the environment, incentivizing small communities to take their own action to kind of protect their own environment and communities. Those, you know, these types of things have been vastly studied in economics, and it's definitely a hot topic in the field, I think.
If I could also add, from my own personal research within graduate school, I noticed that the United States actually has a lot of these kind of programs that we mentioned here about trade for development, right? There's AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act. There's CAFTA for Central America. These kind of things, basically what they do is they try to incentivize trade in exchange for the country, for example, improving their labor standards and their environmental standards. So I will still say that there is kind of an altruistic element, at least to parts of our trade agreements, at least from my personal standpoint and my own research and looking at it.
And Denise, you know, well, what about you? I mean, how do you balance then? Yeah, the industrialization and trade, and the pollution that we see across the world.
Oh, that's an important aspect. I think that ideally we would have more multilateral discussions about that. This would be that's an important direction for us to move next. You know, we need global technologies to help us confront the issue of climate change. We need to change our energy infrastructure greatly. We need and yet right now there are a lot of barriers to collaborations on technological change in the area of climate change. And so this is an important issue, and one that does require more attention.
And gosh, I don't know. Are there other opportunities for women interested in going into economics, you know, to be able to kind of get that crack in the window? You know, whether it's being at the APEC conference, you know, and seeing, you know, just the excitement of world leaders and what's possible. For economics? I mean, I don't know. What's out there for young people?
I think there's actually a lot you can learn. Just so these days, there are a lot of great tools online for people interested, at least in the topics that I'm interested in. So there's a website, VoxDev, which has very easy to digest articles that are essentially summaries of academic works on development, you know, literature in economics. And so you can get a little piece of how, you know, economic tools can be used to analyze questions that are really interesting to me and that you know, the average person might not know falls into the realm of economics. Twitter is also a really great avenue for this because there are lots of very active economists tweeting about their work in ways that are easy to digest for people who are just, you know, maybe new to the subject and just interested in kind of hearing kind of a little tidbits. And so there's a lot available, I think, for people who are maybe interested in finding out how economic tools can be applied to questions that they might be interested in.
I think I'd like to add too, there's a perception, and maybe this is where women undergraduates are holding back from going into economics, where they're thinking, oh, that means I'm interested in business. I'm interested mm-hmm. in making money. And so often women want to have an impact on society. They want to have, they want to be able to influence social change. They have much more of a societal responsibility, kind of a feeling. And so maybe less inclined to go into economics. And that's really a misconception about what economics is. Economics is a foundation for business. All business majors are required to take extensive economics classes. So they need to have those tools. But economics, as Teresa was saying, gives, we have fields that are focused on poverty, we have fields that are focused on families, education, fields, environment, mm-hmm. You know, my field is trade and economic development, trying to look at societal levels of well-being. And, you know, economics is such an important part, but how you interact economics with, like, climate change, that is one of the hottest fields. And actually, University of Hawaii has a lot of strength in that area, that field right now. I can cite a number of economists working on those topics. So there are exciting topics that I think women would find interesting. One of our colleagues, Inessa Love, studies the economics of happiness and well-being. You know, what kinds of choices should you make to be happy in life? I don't know that people think of that as economics, but it is.
If I could also add, in terms of opportunities for women looking to go into economics-related fields, I actually came in through a fellowship program called the Rangel Fellowship. So basically, they helped to pay for my graduate education in exchange for my working for the State Department. But through that program, which targets historically underrepresented minorities, I really found a good community of other women, and we still support each other to this day. also, in addition, I would mention there are other programs like the Presidential Management Fellows Program. And so through that program, you can actually be placed into like the Federal Reserve and other places that definitely need more women. There's also critical language scholarships and the Pickering Fellowships. There's lots of things out there, and they are actively looking to recruit women.
And I guess in the 2 minutes that we've got left, is there anything that you think that being a woman brings to the table in this field of economics? I don't know. Just
well, I do. I mean, economics, it's a field where, you know, it's a mathematical way of thinking, but there's such a human side too. And we tend to be able to bring that human dimension in new and creative ways. And so there's so much that we can offer as women in the economics profession.
Teresa?
I'm a little hesitant to stereotype and say, you know, mm-hmm. women might care more about social issues. I'm sure there are men that do the same, but there are definitely things that Dean Conan is saying that really ring true. And I think personally for me, I view my role as a woman in economics as an important role to be just a role model. Like, it's important to just be here, be visible to other women who are interested in the field. And I think that's an important thing to bring to the table.
Abby, what about you?
I also think, you know, women's interest and the rights for women, that's a core value of the United States, right? And so being able to show, even if it's an uncomfortable situation where you're the only woman in the room, right, in a foreign country or wherever you are, being able to show that the United States cares about these things, the United States cares about advancing the rights of women. And yeah, it's not a perfect process. It's up and down, right? But it's something that we care about and we're committed to. And that kind of representation in the room is always a powerful voice, regardless of whether you say anything that's markedly different than a man, but your very presence changes the conversation.
Okay, and then any final thoughts or hopes for the new year?
Tough question.
I want to eat as much poke as possible before leaving.
Okay, all right, we'll let you do that. We would like to thank our guests, Abby Trenhale, Foreign Service Officer at the Department of State, Denise Conan, Dean of the College of Social Sciences at the University of Hawaii Manoa, and Teresa Molina, Assistant Professor in the Department of Economics at UH Manoa. And we thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. Please contact the Talkback line, leave your comments, call 808-792-8217. If you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.